Hall & Wilcox acknowledges the traditional custodians of the lands on which this podcast is recorded. We pay our respects to their elders, past and present, and to all First Nations people joining us today.
Hello, welcome to the second season of our Capital Markets podcast, focusing on all things ECM, especially capital raising in volatile times. Today, however, we're not looking at capital raising or the listing rules. We're going to talk about something which can arise when shareholders or other outsiders are agitating against a board or management after various blows or insults have been traded, threats of defamation are made. And these can involve claims made against those involved with the company, for instance, statements made in ASX announcements or other public documents that are alleged by someone hostile to the company to be defamatory, or directors or senior executives may themselves feel as though they've been defamed in the public forum and they want to do something about it. To talk about these issues, I'm joined by James Morvell and Hamish McNair. You may recall James from season one. He's a corporate partner in our Melbourne office. Hamish is also based in Melbourne, a very experienced litigator, a lot of expertise and experience in the area of defamation law. So James and Hamish, welcome.
Thank you, John. Good to be here.
So both, I know you both worked together to defend, I think, defamation claims made against key individuals associated with a public company. Just to start off with, might be an easy question, probably isn't. What is the legal concept of defamation?
Yeah, I mean, it is quite straightforward, to be honest. I think most people have an understanding of what defamation is, but at a high level, at least, it's about impermissible harm to reputation. And the reason why I say impermissible is because the law does allow reputations to be harmed in certain circumstances, such as when what is being said about someone is true, or where the circumstances are such that people should be able to speak freely about particular matters or issues. So while it is about harm to reputation, the law does permit harm to be caused to reputation in certain circumstances.
Yep. And in the public company sort of space or forum, how can this sort of area come up? What kind of statements are we talking about?
It's usually in the context of talking about key individuals. So ordinarily, defamation is concerned with claims by individuals, although it can be companies. And it's usually where there's some kind of contest between key individuals, either at the board level or between shareholders, sometimes competitive takeover processes. People will try and criticise the transaction or a particular concept by reference to the people who are involved with it. For example, you know, we shouldn't merge with that company because the guy who runs it is a so-and-so, or, you know, a shareholder is pushing for a particular person to be elected to the board and, you know, the current board don't like it and might make some comments that are adverse to that person, to the broader audience.
I was just going to ask, Hamish, you know, for our audience, many statements are made necessarily by listed companies, you know, through the ASX, by simple company announcements, but also in documents that are lodged, particularly notices of meeting, disclosure documents. Is it the case that defamatory statements can be found potentially in any of those documents, or are some documents effectively immune or not applicable to the law of defamation?
Yeah, the key factor here is the defense of qualified privilege. And so the circumstances of a company are protected. This is one of these areas that I was talking about at the start where the law will permit people to speak freely, and the sort of open exchange of ideas is an important one in corporations. So the starting position is that any kind of documents that are filed with a regulatory authority such as the ASX, or documents that are prepared for the purposes of complying with the Corporations Act or listing rules, they would ordinarily be within the realms of qualified privilege. What takes it outside the realms of that defence are where the publication isn't reasonable in the circumstances, or where it's found to have been malicious, which is where someone set out to harm the reputation of someone else, or whether they've been reckless in relation to whether it would have that effect. So the starting position is that if you stay within your lane, so to speak, in relation to documents that are prepared for that purpose, it will generally be outside the scope of defamation. But there have certainly been cases where people have sort of trodden outside of that path, and that's where you get into these issues.
And people take attacks on their reputation, obviously, sort of very seriously, can get very upset about it. what you've touched on defences. What sort of damages can be awarded for defamation? What kind of remedies are there if it gets to the point of an actual judgment?
Yeah, and it's important to note, I mean, you say that people get upset. I think what we see in our practice for defamation is that you need to have a combination of two things. You need to have ego, so normally it's people who really care about what other people think about them, and you also need to have money, because defamation claims are inherently expensive. So it's usually people who have who've lost out financially or who have the money to fight to preserve their reputation. And coming to the issue of the damages that can be awarded, there are sort of three buckets of damages for defamation. The first one is general damages, which is where the court compensates for harm to reputation. That's on a scale of 0 to 100. So 100 being the worst thing that you could say about someone, you know, that someone is a murderer or a pedophile or something awful like that. That's the worst thing you could say. And 0 being, you know, that someone, you know, hasn't filed tax returns or, you know, some kind of someone got caught speeding or whatever it is. So the court applies a scale of 0 to 100 and then applies that to an index. And the top level of that is 450,000. It changes every year, but that's about the top level that you can get for general damages. The second bucket is special damages. So this is where you've suffered economic harm, and this is where you sort of see the mega awards for damages, where you've, because someone had said something about you, which was defamatory, you lost out on opportunities. You've been fired from your job, or you haven't been able to enter into a transaction, as provided that you can prove that the defamatory publication caused that loss, you can claim under that. And then the third bucket is aggravated damages, and that's where the publisher of the defamatory material acts in a way which the court finds to be inappropriate, such as if you don't apologize or if you don't take any steps to remedy it. So if you sort of double down and be a bit belligerent when it comes to these kinds of matters, you can get an extra bit of mustard on top, so to speak, from the court.
And we've been talking about individuals so far. A company, does a company have a reputation that can be damaged, or can a company itself make defamatory statements about others?
Yeah, so any person or company can be sued for defamation. The key there is that anyone involved in the relevant publication can be sued. In terms of bringing an action for defamation, it's usually limited to individuals, but there are certain corporations that can claim. The first element of those is not-for-profits. And, you know, we talk about not-for-profits as being charities, but for example, in the healthcare sector or in some other kind of financial services sectors, there are significant not-for-profit entities that can turn over billions of dollars, and they will have standing to bring defamation claims. And also the second element there is small businesses. So if you've got fewer than 10 employees, corporations can bring claims for defamation. So those are the three sort of categories of potential claimants: individuals, not-for-profits, and small businesses.
Okay. Back in my law school days, I vaguely remember the tort of injurious falsehood, which sounds kind of medieval. Is that still around? If it is, what is it, and is it still relevant?
Yeah, definitely still relevant. It's a rare bird. It's not as interesting or sexy as defamation. It doesn't make the front page or the back page of the paper, unfortunately. It's very similar to defamation, but it's not limited to disparagement of people. So it can relate to companies and products and services. So it's a much broader concept. The difference between defamation and injurious falsehood is that for injurious falsehood, you need to establish that what's being said is false. So if you're claiming, you have to prove that straight up, as opposed to that being a defense. You need to prove that it was malicious, which is to say it has this element of someone setting out to harm someone else. And the third aspect is you need to prove actual harm. So those elements aren't a factor of defamation. So to bring a claim for defamation, all you need to show is that someone, there's been a publication about you, it's defamed you, you have or will likely to suffer serious harm. That is the... those are the key elements. And then once you get through that gate, you've got a cause of action for defamation. The difference with injurious falsehood is because you have to prove that something's false and you have to prove actual harm up front, it's a much harder claim to bring. But nevertheless, something that we see a lot, particularly with competitors, so companies slagging each other off, or in cutthroat markets, they might disparage each other's products. Sometimes, you know, there are rumours that are spread in relation to, you know, our product's better than their product because, you know, they're being investigated, or, you know, they've got an issue, some kind of product defect or something like that. So you do see that to some extent in that sphere. And the other thing I would just say before I finish on that point is that defamation has a limitation period of 12 months. So you have to get on top of defamation quite quickly, whereas injurious falsehood has a limitation period of 6 years. So that's something that could sort of fester and isn't subject to any of those caps that I talked about on damages either.
Yeah. So the next time I'm drafting my ASX announcement and I want to say something rude about a competitor or somebody else, what should I be thinking about in order to minimize the risk of inadvertently opening up myself to a claim of defamation?
I think the biggest one is to stick to the facts and stick to the truth. I mean, I know that's a bit obvious, but I think obviously we all know the truth is a defense to defamation and to any claim, other claims such as misleading deceptive conduct. So as long as you stay within the confines of what is true, then generally that'll be a safer ground for you to be on. But ultimately, you don't want anyone to be able to even raise a claim of defamation. So to stay in the properly safe zone, you should really be keeping any comments or statements about anyone or any product or company to what is reasonable in the circumstances. So for example, if a competition between board members, you should try and focus on the consequences, not the actual personalities. So try and play play the ball, not the man. And I think sometimes where we've seen these biggest issues, it's when there's these grudges or personal clashes. Sometimes, I mean, the biggest remedy for this is just to get someone else to look over it, someone who's objective and isn't as close to the matter. Because as we know, when it comes to corporate matters, people do get quite upset and excited and want to sort of ventilate their concerns in that way. And we see this particularly with companies that have been started from scratch, you know, startup companies that have grown into these bigger things. The director won't actually see, or the managing director sometimes doesn't see the difference between the company and themselves. So an attack on the company is an attack on them. And sometimes you just need to bring a level of objectivity to this. But obviously, pre-publication advice is something that is also worthwhile. If you're thinking about going to the edge of what you think might be getting into this territory, running it past, an experienced defamation lawyer such as myself might not be the worst idea, John.
Excellent. Thanks, Hamish. That's great guidance there. James or Hamish, just before we wrap it up, anything else you want to add?
Not for me, John, other than to say that, you know, we've had the pleasure of working with Hamish when these issues have arisen and we've had great outcomes. But I think Hamish's final comments there to our audience were timely, that it's better to avoid the problem arising rather than getting caught up in what can be a very, you know, stressful and expensive mess after the fact.
Well, thank you both. Thanks, everyone, for listening today. As always, please get in touch with us if you have any questions. You can find our details on our website, which is hallandwilcox.com.au, or connect with us on LinkedIn. If you enjoyed today's episode, then please rate, review, or follow our podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you.
This podcast is not legal advice and should not be relied upon as such. You should always obtain legal advice about your specific circumstances.